Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. We start out with Professor Sarah Churchill on her book, The American Dream, as she deconstructs Donald Trump and his criminal regime. Then we have a MAGA head chopping wood, complaining about the libs. Then, content warning, Texas Paul. He unloads on MAGA heads, and it's not pretty. Then Stacey Abrams squares off with Georgia Governor Kemp. Music by Jethro Tull, Tampa, Florida, 1970.
I think it's very much a warning from history. That's certainly what I wanted to do with it. And first of all, to say that this has happened before, and we know what it looks like, and we should take it very seriously indeed, because we know what it can lead to. And people have said to me things like, well, you know, you don't want to be, you know, isn't it alarmist to say, to make these kinds of comparisons with fascists? And one of the things I do in the book is show why I think that's a very legitimate comparison to make. It's a comparison that they made in the 20s and 30s. But also because, you know, I don't think you wait and see how bad it gets before you call the alarm. And frankly, nothing that Donald Trump has ever done makes me inclined to give him a chance. You know, everything that he does is so worrying that why would we give him the opportunity to finally expose some decency when he never has before? So I think history shows us that we've got a very dangerous actor. And he's dealing with very volatile and very dangerous elements, and he's treating them very cavalierly. And history shows us how easily you can, you know, put a match to that kind of volatile situation, and it just explodes. History is there to show us, to warn us, but it's also there, I think, to show us that this isn't quite as anomalous as we think. And that's the other thing I want to say, is that this doesn't come out of nowhere. Some people think Trump comes just out of nowhere, and unfortunately he doesn't. And understanding the context from which he emerged, I hope, helps us, well, frankly, from my point of view, fight him. I mean, I just want to fight him.
We cannot win this war for England, regardless of how much assistance we send. That is why the America First Committee has been formed.
I have been doing some research around the ideas of the American Dream and around the ideas of America First and giving lectures and doing some journalism. And then as it started to gain traction, I would give these lectures and people would say, oh my God, are you writing a book about it? And so I started it last spring. So I wrote it in 6 months, 9 months or something, but it was research I'd been doing. And then just wrote that up as fast as I could. So it hasn't even been 2 years that I've been working on it as a book, although I've been researching the ideas for probably like 5 years. When he was elected, I thought impeachment was instantaneously necessary. He was so, to my eyes, so obviously unfit for office, and so obviously criminal. And that's before even the Russian stuff came up. But now I actually think that he so successfully politicized the investigation into him that people would not view it as a legitimate removal unless more evidence. No, who knows what Mueller will continue to uncover and whether that might start to shift the tanker of public opinion. But at the moment, I would say that our best outcome would actually be to remove him in the election in 2020, because that's the result that the majority of Americans would accept as a legitimate outcome. But then, you know, Pence, and then if he gets indicted at that point, then Pence can pardon him. So, or who, you know, and who knows what the Democrat, if we had hopefully a Democrat president, might do. So, I think that the problem with our worry that he won't face justice or adequate justice, he might face some rough justice, but is that I think we very clearly need to send the message that this kind of behavior isn't supposed to get rewarded at a very basic level. And if people watching this, and we see the way that Trumpist strategies are spreading because people see that they work. And I think that degradation and poisoning of the social contract is very, very dangerous indeed. And that's why I think justice matters, because we need to show that we as a society do not tolerate this, let alone reward it. And so the justice is less about punishing him, although I want him to suffer, and I want him to suffer badly for all of the suffering he's caused other people, and for, as I say, the destruction that he's wrought to a country I still love very much. But mostly I want him to see justice so that we restore justice as a norm, or at least the attempt to have justice as a norm. I'm not saying we succeed. The justice system in America is hugely problematic, but that at least we can see to be trying to uphold justice.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
You can say a lot of things about Nixon, and that none of them need to be flattering. But I would also say that he did have certain principles. And although he did break the law in important, serious, consequential ways, there were certain, you know, democratic norms that he also did abide by. And Trump doesn't abide by anything. But of course, the real problem in that analogy is that Nixon was called to book by Republican Congress, who said, "You have gone too far. We will not tolerate this. We will support impeachment. You have to go." And people, I think, sometimes, particularly here, forget that he didn't resign willingly. He resigned because they threatened him with impeachment, and they had drawn up the articles of impeachment. So he was about to get impeached. And the articles of impeachment that they drew up, as we're saying, already apply to Trump. So abuse of power was one of them, right? It was one of the first ones, I think. So the real problem here is the GOP's totally corrupt unwillingness to hold him to account in any way, when he's so clearly in violation of many laws and all kinds of democratic and political norms that are important norms. I mean, it's not just because he's being weird that I'm saying this, right, but I mean, you know, norms that uphold the fabric of a civil society. And I think also people think that impeachment has a criminal threshold, that you have to have committed crimes to be impeached, but that isn't true. Impeachment is removal from office. It's just getting fired. And Congress has the power and the right to do that, to say, "You're not fit for office, we're firing you." Is, you know, so he doesn't, you don't have to be criminal to get fired, you know, and but as I say, I think that we're not in a place where that would do America any good, much as I would like to see it happen personally. I think it would just it would just continue the polarization and divisions, and we've got a long way to go.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
He's made his jokes about being president for life, and you know, he clearly wants to install his family, and the GOP seems willing to do that if that's what it takes for them to keep power. So, you know, who knows? In 40 or 50 years, those historians might not be allowed to read redacted documents. I mean, you know, when Bolsonaro was elected, there were credible reports. I haven't seen them fully substantiated, but there were credible reports that he sent the military police into Brazilian universities to remove anti-fascist histories. So maybe historians in 40 or 50 years won't have access to anti-fascist information, and it will be Orwellian. I don't know. But assuming that we write the ship of state, I think they will absolutely see it as one. It will be like Watergate. It will be one of the great crises of America. But we have we have survived crises before. People keep saying, "Oh, well, we've never been so divided." And well, we did have a civil war, so we were more divided. I think that this is a kind of cold war. It's a cold civil war. It's being fought with rhetoric, not with physical violence for the most part, but of course it's breaking out into physical violence. And those actors who see themselves as legitimated by Trump or in some way are incited by him, including the shooter in the Pittsburgh synagogue, right, who said that he didn't think Trump was anti-Semitic enough, and that's why he went. So the ways in which Trump can incite people are also, you know, volatile. But whatever he does, it seems to end in no good, right? I mean, it's quite remarkable that somebody could be in such a position of power and so have such a talent for making everything worse. Everything that, however anybody involves him in their thinking, he just makes things worse.
Well, hi, progressive leftist. If your idea of a man, is sitting around in your skinny jeans, drinking your Starbucks grande peppermint mocha made with soy whip, talking about how great Biden's economy is and how great Biden's student loan forgiveness plan is, then you keep being you. I'm going to be me, which is a God-fearing American who loves this country, who loves this flag, that just wants to get up every single day and do an honest day's work to provide for myself and for my family, without the government getting involved. Remember that.
This is old Texas Paul. I got to tell you, we didn't have to come down to the cussing pond. We had to get all the way in this motherfucker today. This snapping turtle, water moccasin filled motherfucker. You want to tell me you January 6th participating fucking cheering motherfuckers who shit in my capital, pissed in my capital, fucking tried to overturn democracy, fucking tried to take away our democracy, are going to a goddamn rally and cheering for the first motherfucker that didn't engage in a peaceful transfer of power, and then act like fucking snowflake little melting motherfuckers because the President of the United States called you out and said you're a danger to our goddamn democracy. Well, you know what? Fuck you. Fuck you. You are. You piece of shit motherfuckers. Y'all went to that rally where that demented, deranged motherfucker talked about being 2 weeks ago Zuckerberg was in the White House kissing my ass. Motherfucker ain't been president for 2 years.
Last week, he's a weirdo, Mark Zuckerberg came to the White House, kissed my ass. Sure, I'd love to have dinner.
Talking about 2 weeks ago he was in the White House. And you people are still cheering for that traitor, sleazebag, scumbag, sorry-ass, goddamn con man motherfucker sending him your money, spending money on his shit. Fuck you people. Talking, whining about, well, I guess he's just like Hillary Clinton calling us deplorables. No, I'm calling you sorry traitor motherfuckers is what I'm calling you. You don't get it, I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn that you don't get it. But that's what you fucking are. And the goddamn news media going along with this bullshit. Biden was divisive. No, Biden was defending democracy. That's his job, people. He's the president of the United States. Defending democracy is his job. What is wrong with you people? What is wrong with you people? Jesus Christ. I mean, do y'all have no sense of reality? Do y'all have no sense of reality? The man had hundreds of classified documents that we can't even find them. They're out of the jackets and missing. Yeah, people, they didn't get everything back. They're still looking. You know, people are like, well, why haven't they indicted him? Because they haven't found everything yet. When they did this investigation, they did a comprehensive background check on everything that he was given, went back to account for it. And they can't account for it. That's why they know what they were looking for when they went down there. Jesus, people. And y'all are going to rallies and cheering him? Y'all are some deplorable sons of bitches. You are. Y'all are fucking deplorable. Unpatriotic, nasty. You know who you are? When you see the old videos of fucking Hitler, and you see those big, massive-ass crowds with torches and shit, That's you. That's you. That's who you are. This is old Texas Paul out. I can't deal with these fuckers anymore. I can't deal with them. Fuck them all. 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 Fuck them all.
Midas Touch is unapologetically pro-democracy. And look, we know you are too. So please, make sure you check out our best-selling shirt and our best-selling gear, the unapologetically pro-democracy gear. And hey, while you're at it, make sure you check out my favorite shirt and one of our most famous designs. It wasn't rigged. You're just a loser. At store.midastouch.com. That's store.midastouch.com.
Question is, why are you encouraging people to break the law for you in this election?
Mr. Kemp, you are very aware that I know the laws of Georgia when it comes to voting. In fact, I am one of the foremost experts in the state on expansion of voting rights. And I have never in my life asked for anyone who is not legally eligible to vote to be able to cast a ballot. What I've asked for is that you allow those who are legally eligible to vote to allow them to cast their ballots. And in fact, we took you to court in 2016, and a federal judge said that you illegally canceled 34,000 registrations. You use the exact same system, the exact match system that is under dispute right now. Now, I realize that in the next response, you're going to say that it's a function of my organization because your tendency is to blame everyone else for the mistakes that you make. My responsibility as a leader is to see a problem and try to solve it. When I saw that we had 800,000 unregistered people of color in the state of Georgia, I started an organization that has reached into every county and increased those registrations. When I saw that people were being unlawfully denied the right to vote, I worked to make certain that we held you accountable. And as the next governor of Georgia, I will continue to do my job to make certain that every legally eligible vote that gets cast gets counted.
Ms. Abrams, thank you.
Well, folks, one of the biggest news stories of this week, not involving somebody whose last name is Trump, is Sarah Palin, who lost her election officially this week because of ranked choice voting. Or that's at least the way the Republicans are trying to spin it, including Republican Senator Tom Cotton, who claims that ranked choice voting is just another scam for Democrats to allegedly steal elections. Sarah Palin, of course, was left in a bit of a state of shock after losing this election that she was so certain she was going to win. But darn those Democrats and their pesky ranked choice voting. Here's the thing. The state of Alaska actually passed a voter-approved resolution instituting ranked choice voting in the state. And because Alaska is actually a red state, that means that the Republicans are the ones who instituted ranked choice voting that, of course, prevented Sarah Palin from becoming a member of the House of Representatives, being defeated by Democrat Mary Peltola. Now, this seat that Palin was fighting for had been held by Republican Don Young for many, many years. So flipping it blue might be one of the only accomplishments that Sarah Palin actually has to her name at this point. And for anybody, by the way, who is not familiar with ranked choice voting, because of course it is not something that is very common here in the United States, though it should be, here's basically how it works in a nutshell. You have all your candidates on the ballot. Voters go in, and instead of picking one person that they want to vote for, they pick, well, they rank them 1, 2, 3, 4 in that order. So when it comes time to count the votes, because this election took place a couple weeks ago, what they do is if no candidate has more than 50% of the vote, they take the person in last place and kick them off. So everybody who voted for that person, they then have their second choice. So their vote goes to the second choice. Once again, if nobody hits the 50% mark, they do the same thing, lowest person out, next choice goes to the next person, and so on and so forth. If a candidate hits more than 50% in the first election, ranks don't matter, that person wins. It actually gives everybody a more clear voice in elections by saying, okay, well, if my favorite person can't get it, then maybe my second person can. What it does, actually, according to Republican Representative Adam Kinzinger, is it prevents the extremes of the party from taking over elections, which, of course, is what would have happened had Sarah Palin been victorious. But as Tom Cotton said, quote, 60% of Alaska voters voted for a Republican, but thanks to a convoluted process and ballot exhaustion, which disenfranchises voters, a Democrat won. It didn't disenfranchise anybody. That is a very stupid statement from a very stupid man, which is what Tom Cotton is. As I mentioned, even Adam Kinzinger, a fellow Republican, came out and trashed Cotton for the remark, but so did Michael Steele, the former chairman of the Republican Party, who tweeted out, quote, "Wrong again, Tom. Would love to see your tweet if Palin had won. And exactly how does ranked choice voting rig elections again? Typical BS, claptrap, and no facts. Defeat. It's a real thing, Tom." Doesn't get any more sternly worded than that. But here's the thing. Sarah Palin was a bad candidate. Sarah Palin, believe it or not, according to every poll for several years, is actually a very unpopular person in the state of Alaska. You know, the fact that she even came in second was a bit surprising, because multiple polls, again, over the last couple years, have shown that her approval rating in Alaska is underwater. Most voters who talk to reporters this year, Republican voters, say that, yeah, Palin abandoned us. She quit halfway through her only term in office to go host a reality TV show that nobody even watched, got canceled after one season. And look, there's a lot of reality shows out there, and if you can't hack it on one, I think that says a lot about your popularity. So the voters didn't like her to begin with. So to blame her unpopularity, her losing campaign, on Democrats who didn't even institute the policy that you're mad at, that's about as dumb as you can get. Hey everyone, this is Aspen. And did you know that for the low, low cost of $0 per day, you can subscribe to the Fair and Balanced YouTube channel? We also encourage you to like, comment, and share. But again, click that subscribe button and help Aspen not be so grumpy.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Barbara Ehrenreich recently passed away, so we take a segment on how Barbara gained her worldview. Music by Jethro Tull, Tampa, Florida, 1970.
Join us as In Depth welcomes Barbara Ehrenreich, author of 13 books, including the longtime New York Times bestseller Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. Her latest is Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy.
Barbara Ehrenreich, in your 1990 collection of essays, the book was called The Worst Years of Our Lives, you write that dissent is a traditional value. First of all, where did you get that from personally, and what do you think about dissent as a traditional value?
Well, I wasn't thinking personally. I was thinking of the American Revolution, you know, where you had people like Thomas Jefferson and Tom Paine and so many others who stood up against a king, you know, which was a really difficult thing to do in the 18th century when kings were still invested with a divine right. But they questioned that king, and they helped create a revolution that made this country what it is. And then if you go into the 19th century, you have the dissidents who were the abolitionists, the dissidents who were the feminists, who were the suffragists. So, yeah, I'd say it's a traditional value.
Do you see yourself as part of the dissent movement of today?
Yeah, I'd like to.
Why do you like to?
No, I think I would like to see myself in that context as somebody who raises a voice when she thinks things are very wrong. I'm happy to say it's not a solitary voice. There are so many other voices, and who does not see the need to conform all the time to what we're being told to think or what our leaders might be thinking.
Where did that come from you personally? Where did you learn that?
Well, I think I have to give my parents quite a bit of credit. My father was an unusual person. I mean, he started as a copper miner, working 1 mile deep in the copper mines of Butte, Montana, and he made his way to get an education, eventually became an executive in a big company. But he always said, always ask why. Don't accept anything. Always question. And my mother, too, was a big questioner of things. She was a very liberal woman. They were sort of FDR liberals.
You talk in that 1990 book about your father watching Ronald Reagan on television while he was in the last years of his life?
He had Alzheimer's, yes.
And what was that like? What kind of reaction would he have when Ronald Reagan would come on the television?
A little bit of speech would still come back to him. I don't know if I can even say the words he used on television. But, you know, he would... No, it wasn't when he came on television. That's what it was, Connie, was that when they do tests for your cognitive ability, they ask you who's the president, and he'd say something like, Ronald Reagan. God damn it, you know. So
your mother went to the 1964 Democratic National Convention?
Yes, she was very proud. She was an alternate delegate from Iowa. And she got there, and she joined the sit-in of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. She was powerfully moved by their desire for representation instead of the, you know, white Dixiecrats who represented the South in the Democratic Party then, and she joined the sit-in. I don't know how many white people did, but I was very proud of her.
You were about 23, something like that, about that time?
Something, yeah.
What was that like to have your mother at the Democratic National Convention and have her in a sit-in? How did you feel at the time, I guess, is my question.
In some ways, I was a little mystified, you know, that she would do that. But it was a lesson to me. You know, I myself was beginning to see, yes, there were situations when I might do something like that. But she led the way.
There, we have a picture of you when you were very, very young with your mother and your grandmother and your great-grandparents. Tell me about your grandmother.
That's my grandmother, Bernice Oxley. She was a miner's wife, as you know, I guess we're most of the women in Butte, Montana. She was a very hardworking, stoical sort of woman. When her husband died, she had a little pension, but she went to work in her 80s. She got the credentials in her 80s to become an LPN, you know, to become a practical nurse. And she worked as a practical nurse throughout her 80s. She was, yeah, and this, her name was Mamie McLaughlin. Excuse me, Mamie O'Laughlin.
Mm-hmm.
She was a Catholic. And when her father lay dying, so the story goes, she sent for a priest. This is in western Montana in the late 19th century, 20 miles. The priest didn't want to come. He said he sent a message back. He would come for $15, which was an unthinkable sum for my great-great-grandmother. So she, that was it for her with the Catholic Church. When she lay dying, not too much longer in childbirth, a priest came unsolicited and to give her, administer the last rites and put the cross on her chest. And the story is that she threw the cross off her chest, and that was her dying gesture, and that that's why the lineage was not religious from then on in my family.
You're an atheist?
That's family values compel me to say I was an atheist,
mm-hmm.
because I was raised as one.
Mm-hmm.
But I would not soften that to say agnostic. I would say there's a lot more to know on that subject.
Okay, then you have to tell us the possibly apocryphal story of your great-grandfather being an altar boy.
Oh, do I have to tell that story?
Well, it's an interesting story to see how the religion changes throughout and what it was like.
Yeah, these
for your
are
family.
Also from the Catholic part of the family. Part of the family was Scottish in background. Aaron Reich, by the way, is a name I acquired in marriage.
Mm-hmm.
My maiden name was Alexander, and which is probably Scottish and English or whatever. Part of the family was Irish and Catholic, and this. Story is that this great-grandfather, to get revenge on a priest who, had crossed him in some way, peed in the holy water before Easter. Now, is this true? I don't know. But anyway, that meant he had to leave town, and hence he went west from eastern Canada, ending up in Montana, where I was born.
Where'd you go to school?
Public schools around the country. We went to 11 different public schools because we moved so often. And then I went to college, which I was thrilled to be able to do, at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and ended up going to graduate school at Rockefeller University, which was all Science Institute in New York City.
Why did you move around so much as a child?
Upward mobility and geographical mobility. My father, started in the mines. He got an education. We followed him from job to job.
In 1969, you had your first book published. You wrote it along with your husband, and this is it, Long March, Short Spring, The Student Uprising at Home and Abroad. What were you trying to do, and what was it like to have this first book?
Well, we were asked by Monthly Review Press if we would travel to Europe and hang out with the student movements there, and that's what we did. So we went to, France, very exciting, in 1968. I mean, we got there in just after the big blow-up in May 68, went to Italy, we went to Germany, England, and we also wrote about Columbia University in this country. So it was, I guess, my first experience ever as a reporter.
Had you been had you done your own anti-war movement type of thing for yourself student?
Yeah, my husband, then husband John Aaron Reich, and I were involved in the anti-war movement, and that's, I think, why they asked us to do this. Why they thought we could write a book, I don't know.
Why did you dedicate the book to the Vietnamese people?
Oh, because, at that time we felt bad, as did so many anti-war activists, for what was being done to their country by that war. We call it the Vietnam War. I'm sure they call it the American War or something. And we felt bad. There were a million deaths of Vietnamese people in that war. 55,000 American deaths. So I guess that was a gesture to say, you know, sorry.
Did that, the anti-war movement that you were involved in, how did that impact the rest of your writing and life? Not necessarily just on war, but on other issues too.
Well, it really pried me away from my science career. You know, I had been a pretty good student. I had bopped around from one science to another, from physics to chemistry to physics to biology. But I began to question, is this really what I want to do with my life? What impact am I really having in the world? Suppose I do something that leads to a cure for some disease, wonderful, but what kind of health system is out there to distribute that cure? So I got very concerned about health care, among other issues, and began to think, well, I want to be more directly involved in things that I think are changing, affecting people's lives in a good way. Now, I think I also, to tell you the truth, was not really cut out for laboratory research.
Your biology was your PhD.
Yes, but I'm too impatient. I want the answer now, or in a week maybe. I want to spend weeks and weeks washing test tubes and, you know, worrying about a contamination of some sample or something. I'm sorry.
The issues that, on the health issues, came into your books in 1970. It's been over 35 years since this book was published, The American Health Empire. What were you looking for and what did you find?
Well, this book is actually compiles a lot of people's work. That we did a little group called Health Policy Advisory Center. And we did investigative work about the healthcare system nationally and in New York City, where we were based. So we were putting all that together. And we were really appalled by how poor the treatment of the poor is. And I think if we were doing it today, we'd have to say it would be a lot worse. But, you know, that was our concern, a two-class health system at that time. And at that time was really so much better than now, because most people could afford health insurance. It was just that the health insurance available in the low-income neighborhoods meant you were really going to be like teaching a research material for some medical school.
Now, how did this come home to you in your own personal life? You were having children? Were you children?
Ah, yes, the first pregnancy. I went to a clinic. Mm-hmm. We couldn't afford private care, so I went to a New York City hospital clinic. I won't mention which one. And the care, I wouldn't say it was technically terrible, but it was remarkably sexist. I remember in my ninth month of pregnancy asking a question and perhaps using a technical word. Remember, I had a PhD in biology now. And the doctor saying, now, where did a nice little girl like you learn a word like that? And it infuriated me. And so it nudged me more into feminism, which I had never thought about. I never thought about my gender. I mean, I'd had opportunities that were beyond anything my mother could have imagined, so I didn't feel affected. So I think I like to say that in July 1970, two feminists were born. One was my daughter, and one was me.
We are going to have a three-hour in-depth conversation this afternoon with Barbara Ehrenreich, who has over, 13 books? Somewhere around that order?
That's what you count.
The most popular so far has been this book, Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, sold over 2 million copies. We'll start taking your calls in about 15 minutes, but for those of you who would like to join us via email to ask questions to Ms. Ehrenreich, you can email us at this address, which is booktv@cspan.org. Again, phone calls not for another 15 minutes, but you might want to go ahead and get your emails in, booktv@cspan.org. How many years? Let's see, you're 6 years away from Nickel and Dime now? Probably.
Yes.
2001 it was published.
Published in 2001.
How do you look back on it now? 2 million copies. Did you ever dream it would sell that much?
Oh, heavens, no. I actually didn't want to work on this because I was involved in another book and I didn't want to interrupt the research. The other book has finally come out. It's called Dancing in the Streets. It's a very scholarly book for me, with lots of research and lots of footnotes and so on. I didn't want to interrupt that, but I got myself trapped into Nickel and Dimed by a conversation with the editor of Harper's Magazine, Lewis Lapham, was the editor then, and I was pitching him a completely different idea. And then I got talking about a favorite theme of mine, which was welfare reform and how were women coming off of welfare going to live on the wages available to them. Because I could just look at my local newspaper and see what those wages were. And I said, in frustration, complete frustration, I said, Lewis, you should find someone to go out and do the old-fashioned kind of journalism and try living on those wages themselves. And he said, brilliant idea, Barbara, you. Well, I was a hungry freelance writer, and, you know, here was an assignment from a magazine I wanted to do. So it was initially a magazine assignment, which I took with great trepidation. And I was thinking, all right, I do this assignment, I make a little money, I can go back to the book I'm really, really involved with. Not so. No, when that first article was published in Harper's Magazine, it caused a lot of discussion. And so my book editor said, Barbara, go out and do some more of this and we'll have a book. I thought, well, that's easy for you to say.
Tell me what you did. I mean, what was the process? Your book.
Well, I had to. What I was trying to do was to see if I could support myself on what I could earn in entry-level jobs. And I did this in three different, rather arbitrarily chosen cities. Key West, because I lived near there at the time, Portland, Maine, and Minneapolis, or the Twin Cities area, I should say. So I had to find cheapest places I could to live in, and then I had to find the best paying jobs I could without using any of my credentials. Not that I think putting down on an application form that you're a political essayist is going to get you any kind of job. So, I worked as a maid with a house cleaning service, a waitress, a nursing home aide, a hotel housekeeper, and a Walmart associate.
And no one knew that you were actually doing this
research
for
them? Oh, I was using my name. No, I wasn't undercover. I mean, I did not, in application form, say I was a writer or I wouldn't have gotten hired. So there was that degree of deception, but it wasn't really undercover at all.
What did you find?
Many things. I mean, I found that it's very, very hard to live on $7 an hour, which is what I earned. Sometimes I had more than one job, which made it marginally better financially, but that's a terrible way to live. You know, when the only things you have time to do sort of are sleep and shower and eat other than work. I also learned something very, very important and humbling, and that is that these jobs are mentally hard. Physically hard, I knew, and fortunately I'm in really good shape. But I didn't know, here I am, PhD, lots of books published, that I would be struggling to learn every single one of my jobs.
How mentally hard? How do you mean?
All right, well, an example. You want to be a waitress today? You have to master the computer ordering system instantly. And that's not easy.
Are they all the same?
No, they're all different. You're trying to do it. You're trying to enter some little variation like wants gravy on mashed potatoes but not on meatloaf. And there's three waitresses behind you saying, hurry up, hurry up. You have to remember so much under great pressure. I mean, the amount of multitasking in waitressing is phenomenal. Another example of, they were all hard, but Walmart, I had to I had to be the one who picked up the clothes that were thrown on the floor or that were tried on and rejected or were, for some perverse reason, hidden in the wrong part of the store. And I had to do all that, put them all back. And the point is I had to know the exact locations of hundreds of different items, which would then be rotated every few days for no reason I could ever figure out other than to convince me that I had Alzheimer's.
The name of our group is Jethro Tull. And I suppose we could be Johnny Cash if we tried really hard, but there's a great song by Johnny Cash now called Thick as a Brick. Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My own words better whisper, hit them the same shout. I may make you feel, but it comes and make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink. So you ride yourselves over the fields, and you make all your animal deals, and your wise men don't know how it feels. Yes, to be thick as a fool. The Jews are all swept away. Hey, hey. In the tide of destruction, the moral malaise. The elastic retreat rings a closer play. Hey. As the last wave uncovers, the newfangled way. But you knew she was the one at the heels, and your sun tanners rapidly peel, and your wife men don't know how it feels. Yeah, to be thick as a brick. It's so far away. I'm a bad dream, but I just can't today. When you shake your head, yes, said it's a shame. We'll be right back.
the painter casting shadows on the water as the sun plays on the infantry returning from the sea. The doer and the thinker, no allowance for the other as the failing light illuminates the mercenary's creed. The home fire burning, the kettle almost boiling, but the master of the house is far away. The horse is chanting, their warm breath clouding in the sharp and frosty morning of the day. And the boys is dead while the soldiers sleep the sea. And the youngest of the family is moving with the party, building castles by the sea. He says it's party time to watch them all at you.
just like I did with my old man 20 years too late. And you may call your animal Beals. And your wise men don't know how it feels. Yes, to be sick as a...
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Sex work in the Civil War? We'll find out as Yale professor explains how the Civil War enabled women to engage in class issues. Music by The Who, live in Lenox, Massachusetts, 1970.
The topic, sex in the Civil War, and it's kind of a segue. As you remember last week, one of our readings kind of dealt with the war. Men like the KKK who are using sexual violence as a way to put women back in their place. So we had an opportunity to talk about some post-Reconstruction issues that came up with sexual violence that was heaped upon both white and black women in the former Confederacy, a chapter from Christine Stansel's book. And she dealt with New York City and the pre-Civil War period and the issue of prostitution. So one thing that Christine Stansel found in her research was early in the 19th century, prostitution in New York City was primarily ignored. By the 1830s into the 1860s, you have reformers who are becoming increasingly more concerned about the issue of prostitution. These reformers equated prostitution not only as a moral problem, but a public health problem as well. You have social reformers who were less concerned about professional prostitutes, women who did it, or public women, women who had sex with multiple partners for money, and they became more concerned about young girls and women who were having sex, usually, she would argue, to serve some economic need. So they're concerned about these working class women who are engaging in prostitution as a way to combat homelessness, starvation, and to assist their families economically. In New York City, prior to the Civil War, there was not a statute that dealt specifically with prostitution. Later on, as reformers are encouraging
city officials to deal with the issue of prostitution, we will see prostitutes being arrested under vagrancy laws. And that was somewhat problematic because those vagrancy laws also hurt a lot of homeless women who were not engaging in prostitution. Later on, we will see religious groups, social reformers, into this battle to combat prostitution and to rid New York City of what they deem to be undesirable women. Horace Greeley even comments on this issue of prostitution in New York City. But he equates it to a problem of poverty. So he understood that in order to address the growing trends of prostitution in New York City, you had to address the issue of poverty because you have these working class girls and young women who are engaging in prostitution to meet. So even when we talked before about the idea of women talking about politics, something they started to do during the Civil War, were they doing that primarily during for the Civil War? For was this something new that women were starting to become vocal in politics during the Civil War? Remember, we talked about women who are writing Jefferson Davis and asking that their sons be sent home, right? So we see that transition. But in New York, even before the war, how do these women, these prostitutes, betray this idea of the cult of domesticity, the idea of the place of a woman, specifically a white woman? Any woman to these upper-class men and women who had sex outside of a marriage were considered prostitutes, even if they were not engaging full-time in this activity, right? Because if before the 1830s we had reformers who are really not paying much attention to these activities that are taking place in, I like to call it, the shadows, right? These activities are taking place. But what happens? Where now these women are outside of that shadow, right? They're outside, right? They're public about their activities, right? And so now you have all of these people who have to watch young girls parade up and down the street, scantily clad, right? You see brothels popping up on Broadway, right? And so now it becomes a problem because now it's out in front for all to see. They hadn't been so concerned with these women who were engaging in this activity full time, right? Women who had sex with multiple men for pay. But what becomes a problem is when working class young girls and women are starting to engage in these sexual activities, you know, typically for a short period of time. Well, some of them are doing it for purely economic reasons. Some of these women are working class women, not making very much money in factories or doing odd jobs. And so they're participating in prostitution for economic reasons. In the 1850s, while a resident in residence at a hospital that is now on what we call Roosevelt Island, is catering to women who were prostitutes, many of them suffering from venereal diseases. And while he's there, he conducts a study on these women. And this is some of the interesting information that he gathered. One, he found out in terms of looking at their demographics that these women were primarily married but abandoned. So you see 471 out of 2,000 women that he chronicled were married women who had been abandoned in some way by their men. 8% deserted by husbands, 15% had become widows, and then 57%, the largest percentage, had to deal with women at a young age losing their fathers. He also found that within that population were a lot of immigrant women. So you had 35% of these women were Irish, and another 12% were German. He also noted that a lot of these women were coming from upstate New York. So they were not women who were living in the city, but women who were coming to the city from the surrounding suburbs and actually the rural areas surrounding New York City. And oftentimes those women came to the city with someone who had seduced them and then left them once they reached the city. Found themselves in poverty stricken. They did not have the ability to earn enough to take care of themselves in terms of wages, and they had come to the city to be abandoned. What Christine Stansel tells us to do is to give these women a little bit of room, give them a little bit of agency, right? Look at the idea of inclinations. What was the level of choice? Are these women, to some extent, choosing for their own reason to participate in this activity, in the sex trade, right? So she talks about the domestic servant who is earning a wage, but possibly engaging in prostitution for a change, right? She talks about women who may not have really had an economic need because their fathers were professionals, shopkeepers and skilled workers. Why are they engaging in prostitution if their fathers are making enough to take care of the family? And so she's asking us to consider, were these situations that young girls and women were in where they were the daughters or wives of overbearing fathers and husbands, or even fathers who were cruel to them? So are they escaping something? And then you also had some of these girls who were seduced, came into the city with a lover, were abandoned, and were ashamed to go home. So they stayed in the city, at some point started to engage in prostitution. And then also this idea that these women may have been the wives of abusive men, and so they're escaping abusive men. Also, she talks about this idea of sexual bartering, right? The idea that women are using their body sometimes to get shelter, food, luxury items. Maybe there's some agency here. Maybe women are clearly choosing to go into the profession of prostitution for the express purposes or the express purpose to gain something other than just this purely economic reason, right? Maybe they see working women who are dressed in fine clothing and they want to have that lifestyle. She also talks about women, young girls at an early age who are already engaging with prostitutes on some level, right? Do you remember that part where she talks about young girls who are working for their mothers, who may take goods back and forth between these brothels and home, and so they're seeing up close and personal the activities that go on in these spaces? Can we give them some agency, or do we think that it's they need it to economically survive, and therefore they engage in these activities? You had women who were in the upper classes, and if it was found out that they were engaging in this activity, they were considered ruined women, right? Can't be redeemed, ruined, cast out of the upper class. But that was not the same for working class and poor women. They were seen as people who could be redeemed, people who had fallen on bad times and for one reason or the other had to engage in this activity for just a little while. But these were women who could go on and marry. Because a lot of the current literature that's being produced, one of my girlfriends is writing about prostitution in the early 20th century, and she's using it in a different way than looking at it as just a moral issue. She's looking at it as a way that women are empowering themselves, right? They're able to control where and when the act happens, right? They're forcing men to pay for those services, right? So in some ways, you even have Robin D.G. Kelly in his work about race rebels talking about women being able to use their body, have some control in the male-female relationship, and beyond that, something that is seen as morally bankrupt. Current scholarship is saying, wait a minute, these women are using this to their advantage, right? They're using their bodies in ways that benefit them, and they're having some control in that male-female dynamic. Now, some of the names that were given to women who participated in prostitution, fallen angels, right? Daughters of Eve, daughters of joy, 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 joy. So one thing that Christine Stansel found in her research was early in the 19th century, prostitution in New York City was primarily ignored. By the 1830s into the 1860s, you have reformers who are becoming increasingly more concerned about the issue of prostitution. These reformers equated prostitution not only as a moral problem, but a public health problem as well. You have social reformers who were less concerned about professional prostitutes, women who did it, or public women, women who had sex with multiple partners for money, and they became more concerned about young girls and women who were having sex, usually, she would argue, to serve some economic need. So they're concerned about these working class women who are engaging in prostitution as a way to combat homelessness, starvation and to assist their families economically. In New York City, prior to the Civil War, there was not a statute that dealt specifically with prostitution. Later on, as reformers are encouraging city officials to deal with the issue of prostitution, we will see prostitutes being arrested under vagrancy laws. And that was somewhat problematic because those vagrancy laws also hurt a lot of homeless women who were not engaging in prostitution. Later on, we will see religious groups, social reformers, into this battle to combat prostitution and to rid New York City of what they deem to be undesirable women. Horace Greeley even comments on this issue of prostitution in New York City. But he equates it to a problem of poverty. So he understood that in order to address the growing trends of prostitution in New York City, you had to address the issue of poverty because you have these working class girls and young women who are engaging in prostitution to meet. So even when we talked before about the idea of women talking about politics, something they started to do during the Civil War, were they doing that primarily during for the Civil War? For was this something new that women were starting to become vocal in politics during the Civil War? Remember, we talked about women who are writing Jefferson Davis and asking that their sons be sent home, right? So we see that transition. But in New York, even before the war, how do these women, these prostitutes, betray this idea of the cult of domesticity, the idea of the place of a woman, specifically a white woman? Any woman to these upper-class men and women who had sex outside of a marriage were considered prostitutes, even if they were not engaging full-time in this activity, right? Because if before the 1830s we had reformers who are really not paying much attention to these activities that are taking place, and I like to call it the shadows, right? These activities are taking place. But what happens where now these women are outside of that shadow, right? They're outside, right? They're public about their activities, right? And so now you have all of these people who have to watch young girls parade up and down the street, scantily clad, right? You see brothels popping up on Broadway, right? And so now it becomes a problem because now it's out in front for all to see. They hadn't been so concerned with these women who were engaging in this activity full time, right? Women who had sex with multiple men for pay. But what becomes a problem is when working class young girls and women are starting to engage in these sexual activities, you know, typically for a short period of time. Well, some of them are doing it for purely economic reasons. Some of these women are working class women, not making very much money in factories or doing odd jobs. And so they're participating in prostitution for economic reasons. A hospital that is now on what we call Roosevelt Island is catering to women who were prostitutes, many of them suffering from venereal diseases. And while he's there, he conducts a study on these women. And this is some of the interesting information that he gathered. One, he found out in terms of looking at their demographics that these women were primarily married but abandoned. So you see 471 out of 2,000 women that he chronicled were married women who had been abandoned in some way by their men. 8% deserted by husbands, 15% had become widows, and then 57%, the largest percentage, had to deal with women at a young age losing their fathers. He also found that within that population were a lot of immigrant women. So you had 35% of these women were Irish, and another 12% were German. He also noted that a lot of these women were coming from upstate New York. So they were not women who were living in the city, but women who were coming to the city from the surrounding suburbs and actually the rural areas surrounding New York City. And oftentimes those women came to the city with someone who had seduced them and then left them once they reached the city. Found themselves in poverty stricken. They did not have the ability to earn enough to take care of themselves in terms of wages, and they had come to the city to be abandoned. What Christine Stansel tells us to do is to give these women a little bit of room, give them a little bit of agency, right? Look at the idea of inclinations. What was the level of choice? Are these women, to some extent, choosing for their own reason to participate in this activity, in the sex trade, right? So she talks about the domestic servant who is earning a wage but possibly engaging in prostitution for a change, right? She talks about women who may not have really had an economic need because their fathers were professionals, shopkeepers and skilled workers, right? Why are they engaging in prostitution if their fathers are making enough to take care of the family? And so she's asking us to consider, were these situations that young girls and women were in where they were the daughters or wives of overbearing fathers and husbands, or even fathers who were cruel to them? So are they escaping something? And then you also had some of these girls who were seduced, came into the city with a lover, were abandoned, and were ashamed to go home. So they stayed in the city, at some point started to engage in prostitution. And then also this idea that these women may have been the wives of abusive men, and so they're escaping abusive men. Also, she talks about this idea of sexual bartering, right? The idea that women are using their body sometimes to get shelter, food, right, luxury items. What do you think about that? Let me ask you that. What do you think about the idea that Christine Stansel was asking us? Maybe there's some agency here. Maybe women are clearly choosing to go into the profession of prostitution for the express purposes or the express purpose to gain something other than just this purely economic reason. Maybe they see working women who are dressed in fine clothing and they want to have that lifestyle. She also talks about women, young girls at an early age who are already engaging with prostitutes on some level, right? Do you remember that part where she talks about young girls who are working for their mothers, who may take goods back and forth between these brothels and home, and so they're seeing up close and personal the activities that go on in these spaces? Can we give them some agency, or do we think that if they need it to economically survive and therefore they engage in these activities?
Once in a while.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Today we run a clip by Gays Against Grooming in Los Angeles, California. Last weekend, as they compare Catholicism to groomers to imagine how an atheist even thinks. Then we have a comedian, J.K. Rowling, takedown. Ted Cruz on the Michael Knowles Show making fun of labor. Then we have a black cat that's trained to sing acoustic blues. Then from the movie Idiocracy, President Macho Camacho promises to fix all ailments and economic problems. Then Trump calls for the death penalty of all drug dealers. Then Farron Cousins on Nick Fuente's Groper Movement, how they invaded TikTok. And that's with Olivia Little from Media Matters. And then follow up with The Who, 1970, in Lenox, Massachusetts.
We need to protect the next generation. And you're very welcome. I know. And for these guys over here who are recording me, hey, if a child cannot choose their religion at 5 years old, why can they choose their sex? Think about it. Think about it. I mean, it's just water, right? It's just going to be baptized. No big deal. If you're atheist and your child wants to get baptized at Catholic school without your consent, you should be okay with that. You should be okay with that because you're okay with a five-year-old choosing their gender. So they should be able to choose their own religion, shouldn't they?
Well, look.
Speaking of hate crimes, J.K. Rowling. I don't even need a punchline for that one. No, here's the thing. Here's the thing. People were shocked, oh, she's not the ally of the century. I wasn't. I read the books. Hufflepuff. That is a gay slur if I have ever heard one. And Dumbledore's gay now. Okay. You know, for China, they've cut out all the gay shit. The latest movie. The Chinese version is 6 seconds shorter. 6 seconds worth of gay! I don't know any respectable gay man who only lasts for 6 seconds. We call that a straight at his first glory hole. That is not representation! Also, she's a fucking hypocrite. Because Harry Potter self-identified as a Gryffindor. He was a signed Slytherin at Sorting Hat. But he was Riker. He wanted to get Gryffindor. But are we sure an 11-year-old is mature enough to make that kind of lifelong decision, everyone?
Is every barista no. slacker? Of course not. They're wonderful, great people who are baristas, who, by the way, many of whom don't have student loans and are getting screwed by the Democrats because right. they're saying the guy that studied queer pet literature and has $100,000 in debt because, oddly enough, you know, to reference another podcast, you know, Mickey and Pluto going at it, other than getting a job at Disney, there's not a lot of job market for queer pet literature.
But the greatest thing happened over the last few days. Starbucks, remember Schultz, this guy Schultz? The one with the extremely thin legs. I think maybe Dr. Oz would have said he's either really good or very, very, very thin. But he was doing a debate. He was sitting down. I thought his legs, I didn't think he'd be able to stand up. But Schultz, he's the head of it. And he just announced unions are trying to take over Starbucks. But he will not, under any circumstance, allow mail-in voting because it's evil and corrupt.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of America! President Camacho!
Shut up! Get your monkey ass down. Chill out. Shit! I know shit's bad right now, with all that starving bullshit, and the dust storms, and we running out of french fries and burrito coverings.
Yeah.
But I got a solution.
That's what you said last time, dipshit.
I got a solution. You're a dick. South Carolina, what's up?
That's what I thought. Now, I understand everyone's shit's emotional right now, but listen up. I got a three-point plan to fix everything.
Bring it down.
Number one, we got this guy not sure. Number two, he's got a higher IQ than any man alive. And number three, he's going to fix everything. I give you my word as president. He'll fix the problems with all the dead crap. He's gonna make them grow again. And that ain't all. I give you my word. He's gonna fix the dust on feet. And I give you my word. He's gonna fix the economy.
President Camacho stood before the world and promised everyone that Joe would solve all their problems. He would not only end the Dust Bowl and heal the economy, but he would cure acne and car sickness as well. And if he didn't, President Camacho made another promise. He would kick Joe's smart balls all the way up to the roof of his smart mouth, and then...
Under Democrat control, the streets of our great cities are drenched in the blood of innocent victims. Much of this crime is caused by drug dealers who, during the course of their lives, will kill an average of 500 American citizens. Every drug dealer is responsible, and that doesn't include what they've done to families of people that haven't died, but families that are just devastated by what happened to their children and to themselves. Think of it, 500 people, the average drug dealer. I'm calling for the death penalty for drug dealers, which will, upon its passage, reduce drug distribution in our country on day one by 75%. No more blue ribbon committees telling us what to do, you know? I was setting them up in the White House. There's a blue ribbon committee headed by socialites. And they just want, I mean, look, they're very nice people, but they just want a little publicity for themselves. They can't deal with the kind of killers that we're talking about. We want the death penalty for drug dealers, and you will save millions of lives.
I think they're fascists. I think they want to use the power of the state to change the rest of us.
Falsely branding a political protest as an insurrection, that's is the definition of authoritarianism, of fascism.
Their tactics are fascistic. The left wants power because that is essentially their state of grace.
The blackout of information by the left is pure fascism.
Turns out there are fascists in charge.
Nancy Pelosi is fascistic.
They're using, frankly, fascist policies to silence the right.
They use cancel culture as a tool to impose their fascism on us.
Well, I won't say fascists, but yeah, fascists.
This is fascism. This is fascism of the left.
You were talking about fascism. There's no other word to describe this. This is fascism.
TikTok has become a hotbed for white nationalists that are taking advantage of the fact that the social media platform has very, to put it mildly, lax regulations. Joining me now to talk about some of the extremist content that we're starting to see crop up all over TikTok is Olivia Little, a senior researcher with Media Matters for America. Olivia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So Media Matters, this past week, really, there's two massive articles out there, one focusing specifically on this Groyper movement, if I'm saying that correctly. It's a word maybe not a lot of people understand, so let's hop right into this. What exactly is this Groyper movement with Nick Fuentes?
Right. So the Groypers, it's a loose group of white nationalists who follow or view Nick Fuentes as their leader. And Nick Fuentes is, a white nationalist streamer, online, like media figure.
And he recently, though, he caused a little bit of a stir in his own movement. I guess when he announced he had a girlfriend or something, and that was, they absolutely hated that fact. But of course, that's, neither here nor there. It's just a little weird tidbit to throw out about this guy.
What, people calling me gay because I've never had a girlfriend? I think if anything, it makes me less gay. If anything, it makes me not gay. As opposed to less gay, not that there's any gay, but it makes me not gay. Well, because think about it this way. A gay person, gay people do date girls all the time. Real. And when I said on Elijah Schaefer's show, and they said, have you ever been in a romantic relationship? Have you ever had sex with a girl? And I said, no. If you name searched me on Twitter, as I always do, all these gay people are coming out and saying, I've had more girlfriends than Nick. I've had sex with more girls than Nick. So like I said last week, not only is that thinking flawed, but actually it's the reverse. That actually makes me really more heterosexual than anybody. If we're really being honest, never having a girlfriend, never having sex with a woman, really makes you more heterosexual. Because honestly, dating women is gay. Having sex with women is gay. And having sex with men is gay. And it's all gay. And if you want to know the truth, the only really straight heterosexual position is to be an asexual incel. That's it. So that's all there is. Being a MGTOW asexual incel is really the straightest position that you can have. Having sex in itself is gay, I think. I think that it's really a gay act to begin with. Think about it this way. What's gayer than being like, I need cuddles, I need kisses, oh, I need the... It's all very sus to me, I need to spend time with a woman. That's a little sus. It's a little bit sus. So I think really, I'm like, the straightest guy.
So TikTok, this has become what seems to be just kind of the platform of choice for these white nationalists like Nick Fuentes, even though Fuentes himself, as far as I understand, he's not even on there anymore, is he?
No, Fuentes was banned in 2020 from TikTok, and Groyper content in general is also banned from TikTok, but they're still able to, infiltrate pretty easily and get their content in wide circulation.
So how are they able to do that? What is the Fuentes plan? Because, this article that you co-wrote here, it tells his plan. So what is he doing? How's he getting his stuff out there?
Well, his plan is to flood TikTok with his content. So he's asking his followers to mass upload his videos and clips to make it onto the For You page. And the For You page is, on everyone's TikTok feed. It's the personally curated algorithm, and it's sort of an equal opportunity thing, which is what they're taking advantage of. So an account with very few followers can go viral, can garner millions of views in a way that it can't on other platforms, which is why white nationalists are turning to TikTok to try to recruit, right? And TikTok's moderation is not up to par, and they're exploiting that, right? So Fuentes is asking his followers to, you know, instead of using the term Groiper, to say Gloiper, or do very primitive ban evasion tactics, like changing a letter in a name, or like intentionally misspelling words or his name to sort of circumvent those bans.
You know, it's really ridiculous when you look at things like that, how easily they can escape, you know, the very minimal, again, guidelines and regulations that a site like TikTok has versus YouTube. You know, as somebody who does YouTube every day, we know that whenever there's a mass shooting, if you do a video and you mention the name of the city where the mass shooting took place, not only does the video get demonetized, which, of course, that's not even that big of a deal, what they'll do is they'll almost suppress it to a degree. We don't want to promote this content. So when you have something talking about a real issue on YouTube, they will kind of push that aside and say, no, we don't want that. Meanwhile, you've got these white nationalists over here on TikTok spreading hate, and they're saying, oh, well, what if we just misspell this word? You know, transpose two letters that typically can easily be transposed. That's how they get around that. That's another thing, you know, you use that on eBay searches to find things nobody's bidding on by spelling it wrong. So they're taking that playbook, and they're having, unfortunately, wild success with it. I mean, that's the big problem. Like you point out, these videos are getting millions of views that shouldn't even be there because he's banned, but he goes around to all his other social media sites, tells people to do this. They then go out there, tell other people to do it as well, and it creates an entire network for these people to circumvent all the rules out there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's something that's so predictable that TikTok should be able to predict and preempt, it's quite frankly embarrassing that they're not able to keep up with it, right? Or like very primitive ban evasion tactics from one of the largest social media companies.
Well, another thing that gets me too is if you have, you know, Twitter's easy to search. That'll even show up in a Google search if you type in, you know, whatever the person said. So finding this extremist content on Twitter and Facebook is a lot easier than finding it on TikTok. There's no transcripts of these videos. You have to rely on the keywords. And that's how so much of it does fly under the radar, because if you're not exactly specific.
Right. And often they won't even have captions on the videos other than like the hashtag like for you page. So it's something you have to curate your own algorithm to sort of have it feed you that kind of content, make it think that you're interested in it. And that's the only way to like sufficiently monitor it.
And another thing we're seeing, and again, this is another piece from Media Matters this week, but y'all do some phenomenal work. And another big piece this week from Media Matters talks about this group called Today is America, right? Today is America, which is odd enough title of a group anyway. It doesn't quite make sense, but anyway, they're also using TikTok. And they have an even more powerful, I guess you would call it, network behind them that is pushing, again, not just white nationalist extremism, but they're pushing election lies. They're pushing all this other, you know, right-wing propaganda. And this is a very well-organized machine. And once again, they're doing it through TikTok, aren't they?
Yeah, TikTok and then predominantly Instagram. So the group itself is sort of an evolution of a former TikTok collective that was called Republican Hype House. And that has since been banned because, you know, of like multiple misinformation violations. But those same influencers are now a part of this Today is America like group and network. So they're still posting, but it's interesting because it's not the group posting, but rather they're sponsoring different influencers and ambassadors, representatives, whatever you want to call them, to push far-right content. Like they're either monetarily sponsoring them or they're providing them with equipment, they're providing them with editing services, everything they need to go viral. And this is so predominantly located on Instagram and TikTok.
And there's nothing like this on the left. We have no kind of organization, no well-funded machine pushing out this same kind, the same level, reaching out to people and doing this. And sure, there have been reports that, yeah, the administration has, you know, talked to influencers. But, you know, I honestly see no harm in that. I don't have a problem with it. But when you get down to the grassroots level here, which is what's important with elections, with spreading these messages, the left is so scattered and so divided, really, too, that we could never, as we are right now, pull off something to this degree. And that does hurt us. I truly believe it hurts us, especially with the amount of misinformation out there.
Right, definitely. I also think that, like, they're trying to combat that the left has more organically popular, like, video content, even creators, and the right, and then specifically the far right, doesn't. Right, their content isn't as popular on places like TikTok or Instagram, that they're having to, like, push so much funding to sort of keep up.
You mentioned some of the hashtags that people were using to get around the bans of certain words on TikTok. And so then TikTok said, oh, okay, well, so they went and got rid of some of those words as well. So it's great, but you're just a very reactive platform, and we shouldn't have to be the ones basically doing your job for you. I'm glad you all did, because that made a big difference, but they need to do better.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't have tech training. I'm not getting paid tech money, certainly. But yeah, it's something that they should be able to predict and should be actively monitoring. And it's really troubling that they're not.
Olivia Little, Media Matters for America, great work, and a great organization, by the way. I always say that because, first and foremost, I couldn't do what y'all do. It's bad enough, you know, following right-wingers on Twitter just to see what kind of crazy thing they say, but having to do it every day, that takes the kind of fortitude that I unfortunately do not have. But I appreciate what you've done, and I appreciate you joining us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
It's the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Ranked choice voting. Farron Cousins explains the process. Alaska flips blue. Left Coast Right Wing Watch calls for fundraiser for the Phoenix Zine Fest to help produce two podcasts that weekend. Then a clip from an anti-trans propaganda movie, Trans Wreck. Then a right-wing rant, God is not a globalist. He's a nationalist. Then the Rick Santorum theme song. Then Sacco from HBO sings about Das Kapital. Then a recent Mexican protest song. Finally, Eel sings Whatever Happened to Soy Bomb.
Well, folks, one of the biggest news stories of this week, not involving somebody whose last name is Trump, is Sarah Palin, who lost her election officially this week because of ranked choice voting. Or that's at least the way the Republicans are trying to spin it, including Republican Senator Tom Cotton, who claims that ranked choice voting is just another scam for Democrats to allegedly steal elections. Sarah Palin, of course, was left in a bit of a state of shock after losing this election that she was so certain she was going to win. But darn those Democrats and their pesky ranked choice voting. Here's the thing. The state of Alaska actually passed a voter-approved resolution instituting ranked choice voting in the state. And because Alaska is actually a red state, that means that the Republicans are the ones who instituted ranked choice voting that, of course, prevented Sarah Palin from becoming a member of the House of Representatives.
Blue light is flickering through the city streets. 1 billion TV sets glowing off concrete. One day closer to death, I know that I don't have too long. Whatever happened to Soy Bomb? Lunchbox collector loves all the pussy cats, but when he goes to bed, he wonders where he's at. Thrift store shirts and old haircuts, living in an old sitcom. Whatever happened to Soy Bun? The day cloudy sky. 1 billion lonely hearts beating till they die. One day closer to death, I know that I don't have too long. Whatever happened to Soy Bomb?
The bum on the rods is hunted down as an enemy of mankind. The other is driven around to his club, is feted, wined, and dined. And they who curse the bum on the rods as the essence of all that's bad will greet the other with a winning smile and extend the hand so glad. The bum on the rods is a social flea who gets an occasional bite. The bum on the plush is a social leech, blood-sucking day and night. The bum on the rods is a load so light that his weight we scarcely feel, but it takes the labor of dozens of folks to furnish the other a meal. As long as we sanction the bum on the plush, the other will always be there. But rid ourselves of the bum on the plush, and the other will disappear. Then make an intelligent, organized kick. Get rid of the weights that crush. Don't worry about the bum on the rods. Get rid of the bum on the plush. It's up the ramp to the lumber camp with a sick and aching head. I blowed another winter's steak and I got the gyms instead. It seems I'll never learn the truth that's written plain as day. The more they try to welcome you, the more they make it pay. It's blanket stiff and jungle hound and pitch him out the door. Howdy, Jack, old timer, when you got the price for more. Oh, the boat is getting rocky and I ain't got a bunk. Not a rare, a cheering liquor, just a turkey full of junk. And it's all of my possessions is what I can carry round. I blowed the rest on the skid roads of 100 gypo towns. It's a lumberjack and timber beast, and give these bums a ride. Have one on the house, old boy, when you're steppin' with the tide. Oh, the chokers will be heavy, just as cold, when the hooker gives the highball and we start to dig for gold. And I'll curse the skid road up and down with its rotten, drunken tune. But then, of course, I'll up and make another trip next June. It's blanket stiff and jungle hound and pitch him out the door. Howdy, Jack, old timer, when you got the price for more.